Welcome to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. Today we're broadcasting live from Charleston Wine and Food. We want to thank Ben's friends for making our coverage today possible. This afternoon, we're focusing our conversations on building a sustainable lifestyle and finding balance in the hospitality industry. Big thanks to Charleston Wine and Food for having us here for the fifth year in a row. And I am incredibly excited to sit down with Reem Asil this afternoon. Thank you so much, Reem, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you made the trip out here from California.
Yes, I did.
Tell me a little bit about Reem. So you guys have two locations, right?
Soon to be. I'm actually quite crazily, as you're talking about work-life balance, is that we're in the midst of opening the second location, literally as we speak. We had our soft opening in San Francisco last week, and
well, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. We're hoping to be open by the end of this week.
So. Crazy that you made it out here for this.
It's a nice little break, actually. It's a blessing in disguise.
Yeah. And you have a two-year-old son.
Yes, I do.
So that's a lot.
Yes, yes. But I'm very fortunate because I have an amazing partner who enjoys full-time parenting.
Good.
Yeah.
Two years is a rough age.
Oh,
it's like the best and the worst all at once.
We're starting to feel it. I know. It's amazing. But, you know, I think having a business sort of prepares you for it.
I agree.
I feel like Reem's was a fickle baby for the first 2 years.
So tell me a little bit about the sort of genesis of Reem's.
Yeah.
How did it start?
Yeah. So Reem's was kind of born in 2010, at least in my dreams and my head, after going on a visit to the homeland, and I really discovered these amazing street corner bakeries in Lebanon, and just fell in love with Arab hospitality. I think sort of growing up as an Arab in the U.S., I only saw sort of negative images of myself, and I knew that what wasn't true, but didn't know how to communicate that. And I think, I mean, I will give my mom and my parents credit for really using food as a tool to communicate what our culture is really all about. So I had this sort of epiphany of like, I really want to bring this experience of the Arab street corner bakery and really the warmth of bread and Arab hospitality and that feeling of community. And so I sort of did a 180 switch. I worked in the nonprofit world for 10 years sort of prior to that and sort of quit my job, enrolled myself into a baking pastry program and basically decided to become a baker all in the hopes of starting an Arab street corner bakery.
Amazing.
And in 2014, I was really fortunate to be accepted into an incubator program called La Cocina in San Francisco district, which is an amazing program that really sort of helped me learn the ropes of what it was like to run a food business and sort of built my way. We started at one farmer's market and really I started my business really with this iconic Levantine flatbread called the Manouche. And I was like, I'm going to mainstream that.
Yeah. Is that something you grew up with?
It's something I grew up with, but took for granted. I mean, we had Manouche all the time. My mom would drive us to the Armenian and Lebanese bakeries. And I lived in a very small suburb outside of Boston. And I didn't really quite understand why we were taking 25-minute drives to just eat these breads with za'atar on them. But I kind of understood it as an adult. Like, oh, I get it. It was like a piece of home.
Right.
But it was really until I went to the Middle East as an adult, realized how part and parcel it was to people's daily life. It's kind of like the pizza slice in New York or the burrito in California.
Right.
So I was like, oh, you know, folks need this. Like, my people need this. So I started, you know, just became obsessed with recreating that. And we started as a small farmer's market operation, really creating those flatbreads and quickly grew to 5 farmer's markets. And at a certain point, there wasn't really any space in the incubator kitchen. I was sharing a space with, like, 10 other businesses.
Sure, La Cocina is doing a lot, working with lots of other businesses.
Yeah, exactly. So they helped me find a brick and mortar space, and we found this, like, literally a corner right below a BART transit line in the Fruitvale district of Oakland, which I really love because it's like, it's just like all walks of life. When I imagine what I wanted my bakery to look like and feel like, that was kind of that neighborhood felt right. And so we opened that in 2017, and you know, grew slowly but surely and needed more space. Our catering program kind of took off and had this chance to take over the spot that we used to pop up out of when we were at La Cocina, like right around the block from the commercial kitchen space. And
so that's in San Francisco.
Yeah, in San Francisco. Yeah. And it just felt very serendipitous. You know, I think San Francisco is really expensive. I didn't know if I was ever going to have an outpost over there.
Right.
But we had a wonderful following that really helped us build our brand for the first 2 years of our existence. So we feel very fortunate to be able to kind of go back to where it all started.
So soon you'll have 2 retail spaces,
yeah,
a catering business.
Yes.
Do you do wholesale as well?
We are starting to dabble in it. I mean, from the beginning, it's like Whole Foods, all those folks kind of reached out to us because apparently there's no good pita on the market.
Huh.
Even with a place like Whole Foods, you have like 20,000 dips.
Right.
And like nothing,
and nothing to dip in.
So
I feel like in New York, we're lucky. In New York, we have like Damascus Bakery.
Yeah,
and
we have some pretty good. We have a little bit of those wholesale bakeries. We have some, but not at the quality that you would think.
Right.
Once we get sort of things stabilized, right now our catering and our sort of brick and mortars are where our focus is. But we're definitely sort of exploring what it feels like to do wholesale. Maybe not just our bread, but we partner with a awesome local grocery store called Berkeley Bowl, and they source our falafel.
Nice.
And you know, so doing those sort of strategic partnerships where the brand feels aligned, and you know, people get to learn about Reims through the product.
Berkeley Bowl is amazing.
Yeah, they represent us well. Yeah. You know, so it's not just anybody. You know, so but yeah. We're super excited for what's to come for the next 5 years of Reims.
That's awesome. And so, I mean, what does 5 years look like?
How funny.
I mean, your son will be 7.
He'll be 7. He'll be old enough to
work,
you know,
in the bakery.
Some dishes. he already knows how to flip a pancake.
I bet.
It's amazing. It's amazing what children do and when they follow you.
Yeah.
The only problem is he thinks every kitchen is his kitchen. So anytime we're in a restaurant, he just like makes his way to the back of the kitchen. It's like, my team and I just sort of did a 10-year visioning process and sort of working back from 10 years. We sort of like to go macro and then sort of work backwards.
Sure.
But
so tell me,
you know,
so what is 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years is really what we hope is really to have a place where we have hundreds of employees working, that it's a good, across the board, it's a good place to work.
Yep.
That we're, the folks who started with us around this time are in sort of leadership positions.
Yep.
We've already sort of done that. The folks who started and helped me build Reims from the ground up are still with me.
Great.
You know, like my first person who ever like did cashier at my farmer's market is now my director of operations.
Amazing.
So we did this like visioning of like, what would that feel like? What would that look like? Really, we want to create pathways for people. Yeah. We want this to feel like a career.
You're building community in the business.
Exactly. Yeah. And we want it to be a flourishing ecosystem. But even if people go and do their own things, that they're part of the sort of Reims hub.
Yep.
You know, we want it to be worker owned to some extent. Like, we really believe that, even though ironically the business is named after me, it's so, you know, it's evolved so much since I started it, and that's really because of all of the people that have had input in it and shaped it, and I feel like that's really an important part of the evolution of a business, is to move your people along with you.
Sure.
And to build your leadership. So we did a lot of that visioning, but you know, we hope to have a few little, we call our little bread empire, but a few brick and mortars and a robust catering operation where we're, you know, we're already starting to be a part of people's special events, whether it's their weddings or, you know, big business, you know, corporate events. But, you know, really growing that part of our business, because we feel like Arab hospitality is something everybody should have. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about, what does it look like when someone walks into Reims? Like, what are the available options on any given day?
Yeah. So Reims is just a really vibrant space. I feel like when people ask me how would you describe your food? I'm like, it's Arab, It's like second generation immigrant. It's yeah. Oakland. It's right. California. Like there's so much familiarity in it, whether or not you know Arab food or right. not.
Do you think that there are things that you're doing that are not necessarily super traditionally Arab, but are incorporating some of that California thing?
I never claim one thing or the other because I'm always surprised by how innovative, like even if you go back to the Arab world, people are evolving, right?
Right.
So I would say the food is very much a culmination of all my cumulative experiences. So when you walk in, you know, the menu is going to be very accessible, you know, when someone walks in, it describes what a manoushe is. We say that we'll still love you and feed you even if you can't pronounce it. You know, our menu is mixed with things that are Arabic words and some educational component to it. But then also just like, you know, our best seller is called the Pali Cali. You know, it's a mix of Palestine and California.
Sure.
You know, Musakhan is, that's the dish it's like sort of modeled after, which is like the iconic Palestinian dish with sumac braised chicken.
Yep.
You might not be able to pronounce that. So we've sort of made it accessible. So it's a little bit of a mix where people sort of feel familiar and at ease. Our staff is really diverse. We've done a really good job. And I think it's just organically. Like, I don't think we've done anything. I mean, we're intentional. Obviously, we prioritize people with the most barriers to employment. But I think just by nature of who we are and sort of what we represent in terms of like social justice being at the core value of the business, that we tend to attract people from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So it's very much a reflection of neighborhood and the space we're in. San Francisco is the same way. Like everybody we've hired is from like a 1 mile radius of the bakery. So
let's talk a little
exciting.
Bit about that. I mean, about the social justice aspect. I mean, so it's incredibly hard to start a business by yourself, start a small business, to bootstrap it, to get these things off the ground, but then to add a layer on top of that and say that you are only going to, or you're going to prioritize people who have a difficult time finding employment, that's like you're adding more work for yourself
in
creating this community.
Yeah,
I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I wish people would invest in that more. I mean, I think I don't have the advantage that maybe some other folks do in that we didn't have a lot of capital invested in Reams up front. I feel like there's so much more I can do. I feel like I'm never doing enough, but we do invest a lot in the short term. In terms of how we hire, we take our time hiring folks. Like, we do really prioritize people with the most barriers, but we throw them through the gauntlet before they can actually.
Sure.
We don't just like hire out of desperation. Yep. We really make sure our values are aligned. We really we look at people and their potential for leadership more than their skill set, because you can teach that, but you can't teach people integrity. You can't teach people sort of the value of team, being a team player.
And showing up on time and like all those
things.
Yeah,
like leadership, you know, and even people who've been knocked down in their life, if there's, they show these like sort of leadership qualities when you let them shine, because probably in their life they haven't been given that chance, right?
Yep.
But that takes more time and it takes more resources. You know, we pay for staff meetings, we pay for trainings, we do all of these things. And it definitely does, it makes us a little less profitable in the short run, but in the long run, it's helped us because we have a much longer retention rate than sort of my perception of my peers in the industry. I know that that is a really hard thing. I mean, we struggle with it because the systems around us that we can't control, like expensive housing and transportation, like there are definitely things that make it harder for our employees, but for the most part, we've been able to keep the really good ones because we've like sort of invested the time. There's sort of that invaluable thing that, I mean, we also pay a little bit more competitively, and I think that helps.
Of course.
But people, you know, people work for a variety of reasons. I think wage is not just the only reason. There's like all this sort of invisibilized value of like being invested in professionally that I think people in the food industry, because you're always in the weeds, don't take enough time to do. For better or for worse, we try to take that time. You know, my staff, I think, appreciates it. But it's definitely a little bit of a process.
Yeah. Have you found that people who maybe don't come from an Arab background who work with you have then taken up eating and sort of consuming and sharing the breads and Arab hospitality in their own community?
Oh my God, I love it. I think that's the coolest thing about Reams, actually, is that it's, you know, we have some Arab employees, but quite the majority are non-Arab, and they just like are the best ambassadors. Like, we do Arab hospitality and the trainings and things like that, but like the thing is, hospitality is transcendent. Every culture has sort of some version of it, and so we really try to speak to people's cultures and how do they find that personal connection to it. And there's nothing better than sort of my non-Arab employees, sort of, and even like the Arab customers who come in are like so impressed, you know, being able to talk about the food and be proud of it and eat it. And I think one thing that I've really sort of tried to do is be flexible. I mean, you know, I'm not old school myself. Obviously, right. My food is not super, super traditional, but there are things that even I have sort of old school, but I try to like be flexible because my employees are also thinking about sort of the intersections of this food and the flavors and the ingredients with their own culture.
Right.
And then like making their own dishes and like, oh, that's really cool. Let's put that on the menu.
Right.
And so we've done a little bit of that. And I feel like that's how the menu has really evolved, is like having the input of people. Yeah.
Are there any ingredients that you grew up with or that are like very traditional Arab that you have a hard time getting?
Let's see. I mean, getting a good za'atar, actually, you'd be surprised, is really hard. I think a lot of the za'atar that's imported from the Middle East is, you know, because it's like created for mass production, they're like bulking it up with stuff. So, but then on the other hand, if you get the local stuff, it's like really expensive. So I've had a hard time. Like, my mom never really made her own za'atar, but we had access to a lot more in the East Coast than we do in California. So I've had my sort of dream of like creating my own za'atar farm where we can scale that up a little bit.
I mean, what do you need for that? You need sumac, you need sesame,
and then the za'atar plant. So za'atar is the spice mix and the plant.
Oh, interesting.
I know, Arabs are very confusing. We call the same thing for different things. But it's basically a hyssop, oregano plant. And it grows probably really well here. The climate in California, the climate is very similar to back home. So in terms of ingredients, I'm just trying to think of, like, I've been able to recreate stuff that a good ghee, like clarified butter, it's hard to find. I would say za'atar, it's finding that good quality. We get ours from Jordan.
Got it.
And it's pretty good, but I always looking for better.
Yeah. As far as like inspiration, do you travel back to the East Coast and those Arab communities that you were a part of when you were young? Do you go to the Middle East?
I have not been back to the Arab world since 2010.
Okay.
And I've been wanting to go back ever since my business took off. I haven't been afforded the time.
Sure.
But I'm long overdue for a trip back there because things evolve. You know,
well, it'd be great.
I only watch them from afar, and I'm like always just like, I'm longing to go there, you know. I was really fortunate. I was in the cookbook. La Cucina did this compilation of all of our recipes, and they did this book tour where we got to go to different places, and I was able to accompany them to Detroit. And that's like the promised land for Arabs.
Right.
Because there's Dearborn is right there.
Yeah.
It feels like the homeland. And I'm
oh,
I've been robbed. Like, how come I didn't have this? But that was really an amazing experience to go and, you know, see how things have evolved and how things have not evolved, you know. And I'm just like curiosity around that. But just to be in a space where people are speaking your language, it's like something I longed for, because we had to really travel when I lived in the East Coast, because we lived in a very small suburb where we were the only Arab family. To be able to see people so concentrated in an area was really, really cool. I'm very fascinated about other parts of the U.S. where that happens, in the Midwest especially.
Right.
I feel like there's a lot of enclaves. Definitely New York, obviously. But yeah, I... I sort of tried to create, I mean, that was the reason I started Reams in California, because I'm like, where are all the like Arab spots at? They're all kind of hidden, you know, they're off the beaten path. Yeah. So I wanted to create it a little bit more centrally, but I basically trying to create home out of something that wasn't there. Yeah. And I think there's something cool about that too. Pioneering that, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. As we wrap up, where can people find out more online about you? What's your Instagram?
Yeah, handle? So if you want to learn about Reams California, you can always visit our website at www.reamscalifornia.com, or you can follow us on Instagram at Reams California. You can also follow sort of what I'm doing at ream.asiel.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for sitting down. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Harry Rosenblum from Feast Your Ears. Thanks again to Ben's friends for making today's coverage possible. Stay tuned for more from Charleston Wine and Food.
This program is powered by Simplecast.